A few of you I know have, I see complete texts out there. I didn't run this off, but if you have a complete volume, turn to number 65 in the sonnets. If you don't have it, don't worry. I'm going to do this very quickly. One of the problems with starting with number 18 is it can make the poet look very arrogant. And in number 18, he's proud of his accomplishment and is asserting that he's written a very great poem that will survive as a poem as long as human beings read poetry. But that was the attitude in the sense of a moment can change quickly. I want to look quickly. I'll just read through number 65, which has something. I mean, we're dealing with the same question. How do you preserve that which is under attack by nature? Okay? And he is again thinking about the nature of the beloved. How can it be preserved? And in number 65, we get a very different attitude toward the effect of nature, the passing of beauty, and the ability of the poet in a poem to capture and preserve anything. So I'm doing this by way of contrast. 65. Since brass, nor stone, nor earth, nor boundless sea, but sad mortality or sways their power, how with this rage shall beauty hold a plea, whose action is no stronger than a flower? Oh, how shall summer's honey breath hold out against the wrackful siege of battering days, when rocks impregnable are not so stout, nor gates of steel so strong, but time decays? Oh, fearful meditation, where alack shall time's best jewel from time's chest lie hid? Or what strong hand can hold his swift foot back? Or who his spoil of beauty can forbid? Oh, none, unless this miracle have might, that in black ink my love may still shine bright. Very tentative. Time is going to destroy everything. Rocks, the sea, gates of steel. And the only thing beauty can put up against that overwhelming destructive force is a flower. Okay? Then he looks at the beloved. What's going to happen there? That looks as if that beauty will be destroyed too. Who can stop it? Who can hold it back? No one, unless there's a miracle. And this pathetic little poem survives. It does. It's my current favorite, by the way. Just the nice thing about teaching Shakespeare is you sort of get to anchor on some of these things occasionally, and they get in your brain and stay there. It's my current favorite. Number one on the sonnets hit list is number 65. But the tentativeness of that is very different from number 18. Same theme, same idea, but totally different. Written on a day when he feels completely inadequate and feels that poetry can barely do anything, or it will take a miracle for that poem to survive and capture any of that beauty. Miracle occurred. It's still there. It's a great poem. It's a very great poem, but very different. Okay, here's what I'm going to do in this hour. We're gonna tear number 73 to pieces. This is, let me quote the other great English poet, William Wordsworth, who said, "We murder to dissect." And it's true, you know, if you're gonna find out what makes a frog operate, you're gonna kill the frog in the process. Well, I'm about to kill number 73. I apologize in advance. But I want to look at it from every possible point of view, to give you a sense of the complexity of the verse and what poetry can do. This is going to get even more complicated when we transfer it to the stage and put it in the mouths of individual characters. But here we're on what we call a close analysis of number 73. Let me read it through once and then we'll go at it. It's on the back page. It's on the back page for those of you looking. That time of year thou mayest in me behold, when yellow leaves, or none, or few, do hang upon those boughs which shake against the cold, bare ruined choirs, where late the sweet birds sang. In me thou seest the twilight of such day as after sunset fadeth in the west, which by and by black night doth take away, death's second self that seals up all in rest. In me thou seest the glowing of such fire that on the ashes of his youth doth lie, as the deathbed whereon it must expire, consumed with that which it was nourished by. This thou perceivest, which makes thy love more strong, to love that well, which thou must leave ere long. Beautiful poem, beautiful poem. Very melancholy. It's a melancholy poem. It's about the coming on of age. It's the, or more so, the feeling of age coming on and what it's going to mean. I'll give you the prose summary. This is just awful. Here's the Folger prose summary. In me you see the autumn of life, the twilight of day, which will soon yield to night. Seeing this, your love is strengthened for one whom you must soon lose. Prose is inadequate. We're looking at heightened speech, which captures the intensity and complexity of an emotion. Okay? The flat prose doesn't begin to capture the same thing that the poem does. The poem is doing it in a very different way. First thing I want you to do, this is very clearly and evidently structured. Quatrain 1, quatrain 2, quatrain 3, turn couplet. So just for convenience sake, mark off after line 4, after line 8, and after line 12. Because right here we have, this is often the first sonnet I teach in order to teach structure. Because here it's very clear. The first four lines, the first quatrain, a unit. Second a unit, third a unit, and then comes the turn, and the couplet gives an alternative point of view. Okay, we get the little change before the couplet. Each of the three quatrains deals with a different image. Unlike Sonnet 18, where we saw images running throughout the poem, each quatrain focuses on a single image. So that the first four lines, the first quatrain, begins with the poet who has this melancholy feeling, I'm getting old. You look at me and you see someone who's getting old. You look at me, here's what you see. Age coming on, and in order to convey that sense of melancholy, time passing, he turns to that place, that time, when we all feel that to a degree, and that is autumn. Autumn is indeed the time of year when even those who are young feel melancholy and feel time passing. And let me tell you, when autumn comes and you're older, it's even more pointed. Because you've got more of it behind you and even less of it ahead of you, so each autumn becomes more important. Now, we're just looking at the first four lines, and I'm paraphrasing, I'm doing a prose rendition. You look at me and you're going to see a particular time of year. So the image pattern he begins with is generalized in terms of the seasons. That time of year, you may and me behold, okay? You look at me, you're going to see a time of year. Well, that's not true. He's speaking imagistically, okay? Say, I look at you and I see June. I see September. No, it doesn't work that way. He's speaking imagistically. You look at me and you're seeing something like what I feel. Okay, but look at that first line. Scan the first line for me. It's what we did yesterday afternoon. It's easy to do because the first line is very regular. So that if you look, I'm going to do it now because we need to keep moving ahead. The accents fall on time, year, mayest, me, hold. Okay? And it's an absolutely regular line. We have pure iambic pentameter. What's very interesting, the first accented word of the poem tells us the subject of the poem, time. And this is indeed a poem about time and the coming on of time. The second accent gives us the general image pattern, time of year. We're talking about the seasons, but we don't know what season yet. And then he plays a little joke on us. The denotative meaning of the verb mayest means perhaps, if you so wish, you are able to. But of course, if we're talking about a time of year and the poet then uses the verb mayest, the connotative meaning, we can't help but have another association, is, oh, he's talking about a time of year, he uses that verb. What season are we talking about? Spring, early summer, until the second line where we get yellow leaves and boom. We've suddenly moved ahead because yellow leaves defines autumn. It's using a little connotative joke in the first line in order to hammer home that sudden movement of time forward. And in line two, it's very clear, we're talking about autumn, okay? There's no doubt about it. Let me give another example. Yellow. This is very strange, but it's the way things work. We all have connotations with colors. Yellow means, specifically, denotatively, the color of this paper. That's yellow. That's the denotative meaning. I use the word yellow, I'm referring to a specific color, that color. But yellow also has connotative meanings. If I walked up to a friend that I was annoyed with and said to that friend, "You're yellow," I wouldn't necessarily mean that my friend was of a particular color, like that paper. I would be saying to my friend, "You're a coward." And yellow has come to assume the connotation of cowardly. Okay? Yellow also can have the connotation of sickness. It comes from the disease of jaundice. It comes from the fact that people who become ill often change their complexion and get a yellowish tinge. So it can mean illness. We have connotations with the color of yellow that suggest sickness, weakness, fear. And there's going to be a color pattern running through this poem. He's talking about the yellow leaves. He means leaves of a certain color that we see in autumn. But the introduction of the color yellow, that possibility. But yellow is also the sun, gold, very positive things, okay? There's a reason why the yellow brick road that led to Oz was yellow. And it has to do with that sense of things which are precious and life-giving. Almost any color, if you look at its connotations, will have contrary connotations. Okay? They will tend to work and pull in two different directions. It's fascinating. Well, poets will use those. And in this poem, we get that pull because we're going to look through a color pattern, and we get it at the beginning with yellow, which can mean things which are precious, life-giving, that we cherish, and those which are sick or dying or fearful. And we get the double whammy of that color. That time of year thou mayest in me behold when yellow leaves. Okay, it's autumn. But now he's going to specify what time of autumn. The yellow leaves, now we're dividing down. We move from seasons, the general flow of nature, to a particular season, autumn. Now we're going to subdivide this into stages in autumn. And the yellow leaves first appear early in autumn. The leaves were green and then they begin to get a yellowish tinge and then they turn yellow. And we're in early autumn. And then suddenly, when yellow leaves or none, where are we? late autumn, the end of autumn. Autumn's over. Those leaves are gone from the trees. Or few. Wait a minute. We're now in late mid-autumn. Do hang. Line 2 is illogical. Line 2 is a disrupted pattern. Because the logic of the line, if we're talking about the coming on of the seasons, should read, when yellow leaves or few or none do hang. The poet is deliberately shifting time. He is deliberately breaking the natural flow of time. Shakespeare was smart enough to have changed those two words if he wanted to. I just did it, he could have done it. And put it in the logical, natural order. Why does he shift it? Why does he do it? Because he's telling us something about the speaker of the poem, the voice in the poem, who is saying, you look at me and I'm like early autumn. No, I'm like the end of autumn, right before winter comes. Well, wait, back up. There's a little life left in me. There are a few leaves hanging on my tree. I ain't quite dead yet. So the poet quite literally goes from early autumn, late autumn, and says, oops, wait, I'm putting a few leaves back up there on that tree. I'm not gone yet. And we have the poet in the image pattern holding on to life, clinging a little bit. We've got a few leaves left on that tree. He is fighting time by disrupting the pattern of time in the process of the verse. And it is an assertion of some life remaining in him. However, as soon as he says, now scan the second line for me, all right? When yellow leaves or none or few, and what word does the last accent of the line fall on? Do hang. Last accented word in the line, and of course, denotatively it means leaves attached to the branch of a tree. Connotatively, I say to you, hang, and what do you think of? And the line ends with a strong connotative word of the end of life, okay? Not nice little leaves necessarily hanging on the trees, but a rather more profound image, okay? And notice where he places it. Comes right at the end of the line. It gets the last accent of the line, but the line moves right on. It's what I called enjambment yesterday, okay? When yellow leaves or none or few do hang upon those boughs. And we get denotative again. Those few leaves are hanging upon those boughs. There are a few left. Now just a minute. What's the difference between, and he could have done this, we're now into word choice. Poets making word choices. Shakespeare knew the word branch. He uses it many times in his poetry. What's the difference between a branch and a bough? And why does he choose boughs? They're essentially the same thing, with tiny differences. And a good poet will be aware of these small differences. If I say branch, you think of something on a tree moving outward, correct? A branch from a tree moves outward and tends, as we think of it, to reach up a little bit as the other branches. If something branches out, we think outward and upward. I say boughs, you get a very different image of a tree. What are those limbs doing? Hanging downward, going downward, okay? Going downward. And we get that sense of movement downward in the word bow. Listen to the difference in sound. If it was to hang upon those branches, you know, or upon those boughs. And we also get the linking of the O sounds, upon those boughs. And he's playing with the O vowel at the beginning of the line. But we have a connotation again. Bows, bows. What happens to you as you grow older? I have a wonderful aunt. I love her dearly. She's about to be 85. You wouldn't know it. She looks better than I do. Except this, when I came home a year ago, I noticed for the first time the shoulders stooping. And we say quite literally, and it happens, as you grow older, what happens?
You get bowed down with age. And there's the sense of it's the bones changing and the gravity pulling you downward. And the word bows again suggests that. This is one of those things I had a student suggest once and I couldn't say no. Because I was talking about connotations and he said, wasn't the poet also a playwright? And don't you take bows at the end of the... I said, wow. I said, you know, but it's my rule. If there's a pun in Shakespeare, I say it's almost always intentional, but I don't know. That it's stretching it, but it's one of those things that amuses you when you're teaching a class. Anyway, upon those boughs which shake against the cold. Now, notice the use of the preposition at the end. And notice what's happened. Mid-autumn is moving more and more towards late autumn. We've just got a few leaves left on those boughs, and they're shaking. Why? Because that winter wind is moving in. Okay? But look at the preposition. They're not shaking in the cold. What are they doing? They're shaking against the cold. And by choosing that preposition, we've got a fight. Those leaves are not going easily. That cold wind may be coming in, and those leaves may be shaking, but they're shaking against the cold. They're fighting the coming on of time. They're fighting the natural process of the wind pulling the last of the leaves off the tree. There's fight in the speaker. The voice of the poet is fighting and is aware of that fight, okay? Upon those boughs which shake against the cold. Got it? It's a regular line. The first three lines of the quatrain have been completely regular, although we have to pause for a moment and look what happens as he changes the sound within the line. Divide the line in half, okay? First four words, it's an eight-word line. Upon those boughs which. Upon those boughs which. The sounds are what? P, B, F, H, O, Hu, Sh. Very soft. Look at the last four words of the line. Shake against the cold. What dominates? K, G, St, K, D. And we suddenly get hard sounds. And not only do we have those leaves shaking against the cold, we have sounds of the battle, and the sound of the line gets harder. Upon those boughs which shake against the cold. And you can hear a fight in the hardened sound. That's what poetry does. Sound is conveying meaning. Sound is conveying meaning as well as the sense of the words. And I take it one step further. What do you do when you're standing in a cold wind outside? Your teeth begin chattering and you hear it in the sounds of the lines. Upon those boughs which shake against the cold. If you're really cold outside and your teeth start chattering, those are the sounds you make. It's the sounds cartoon characters make when they're standing in a cold wind. It's so cold. And those sounds enter the line as the wind blows in. It's a wonderful little touch, okay? And then we end the first quatrain with an image of those trees which become bare, ruined choirs where late the sweet birds sang. It's a beautiful line. Okay? Now, the image is a wonderful image. I can speak to you about this because you know something. It's wonderful. The choir refers to an actual part. It's an architectural term having to do with the great cathedral, all right? We go to Notre Dame, we fly over, it's in the shape of a cross. That's how it's planned, okay? If that choir, okay, which is that sort of long expanse of that architectural part of the construction of the cathedral, were to be destroyed, were to be ruined, we land, somebody's bombed Notre Dame, and we're looking at it, and all that is left of the cathedral are the bare ruins, What would the bare ruined choir part of the cathedral be? It would be those long arches going up that provided the support. And we're looking down the choir, okay? So we're seeing these long Gothic arches. And bits and pieces of those buttresses that help support them outside. Do you get the image? He is using the ruined church image to give the image of bare trees standing in a forest without their leaves and just the bits of boughs and branches attached. It's like looking at a destroyed cathedral. The choir has become bare and ruined. It's a wonderful visual image. It is an image that introduces the idea of the sacred into the poem. What has been natural now suddenly has a larger context, a sacred context. We're talking about a church. And it is historical. It is the image of churches being ruined. Something that was haunting the poet that we'll talk about when we come to Hamlet. Henry VIII had ordered the stripping of the monasteries and the destroying of many of those images, and we had bare ruined choirs throughout England. Okay, it was a powerful image at the time. Bare ruined choirs. Except it wasn't the monks who sang in the choir, because we're talking about trees. That's where the birds sang. The birds sang in those barren trees that look like bare ruined choirs, and they sang late. Notice the placement of the word in the line. It means just recently the birds were singing here before they took off and headed south because winter's coming. Just lately they were singing in those trees. It means during the summer the birds sat in those trees and sang when? Late into the night, because the sun stayed up. In the summer, the birds sang late in the trees, because their song would go on until the sun set, and the sun didn't set until late. And connotatively, I say the word late, and what do you think of? Death. The one who is passed on. Okay, there's a connotation to, when I finally keel over, it'll be the late Doc White, okay? And late has that connotation with it as well. Bare ruined choirs where late the sweet birds sang. The music is gone. The music has left. The birds have departed. There is no song anymore. And the very church, nature itself, is in ruins. Scan this line. Good luck. I'll give you just a second. Scan this line. Bare ruined choirs where late the sweet birds sang. Let's start by putting in the five accents that we know are there. And they're there in this line. What is the first accent just taking strict iambic pentameter? Rune. Yeah, rune. Rune. Okay? What's the next one? Bare ruined choirs. Choirs. Okay? The next one. Bare ruined choirs where late, got it? The sweet, yep, birds sang. What's the last accent of the line? Sang. Now, look through the line, however, and tell me what other words are of such importance and power in understanding the line that they've got to be accented. First word, bare, you cannot toss that away. Which means this line is opening with what? Aspandi, that double accent. Bare ruined choirs. Where late the, and what happens at the end? Sweet birds sang. Yep, we got three accents lining up. The line begins with aspandi. The line ends with aspandi. You gotta accent birds, okay? It's the subject of that little clause there. You have to have it. Which means, how many accents do we have in this line? We only have three unaccented syllables. We've got seven strong accents. And curiously, as the poet is saying what? I'm getting old, I'm getting weaker, I'm passing. The last line of the first quatrain ends with bare ruined choirs where late the sweet birds sang. And there's strength in that line. There is power in that line. Also, look at the change in sound again from the beginning of the line to the end. Bare ruined choirs where. We got R's everywhere. Okay? We've got the D, K. We've got some strong sounds there. And then we get late the sweet birds sang. What happens? What comes in? S sounds. Sweet birds sang. Okay? That L in late is a very soft sound. Where late the sweet birds sang. Soft T. Late, that gets connected. The S's get connected. Okay? The one thing that we do get in the line, connecting the first half of the line and the second half of the line, the B's. Bear and birds. Very similar, bear and birds, very similar. But how it's changed from bare ruined choirs, where late the sweet birds sang. And as he talks about sweet birds singing, the sounds of the line lighten and get softer. Poetry does in sound what it's talking about. Okay? This is a brilliant line. This is a wonderful line. It's the sort of thing you just, you know, you could sit and just stare at this line and say, boy, how did he put those few words? Those words really go together well. Those are nice. First quatrain. There we have it. But please notice, I'm going to do this very quickly. I'm going to pound out the first quatrain. Notice the rhythm. We start with regularity with our iambic pentameter. That time of year thou mayest in me behold, when yellow leaves or none or few do hang upon those boughs which shake against the cold. Bare ruined choirs where late the sweet birds sang. What happens to the rhythm? You come to the end of the quatrain and it's the car that's been, the motor that's been running so smoothly, suddenly is jerking and shaking. I always say the reason iambic is the most popular rhythm is because that's how our heart beats. Short, long, pump, 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 pump. That's how you're pumping blood through your body. That's what the heart's doing. Pump, 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 pump. We come to line four, there's a heart attack. And just boom, 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 boom. Okay. Or at least an irregular heartbeat. It's just get him to a doctor. Whoa, something's gone wrong there. And he sets it up with those three absolutely regular lines before he throws that one in. Second quatrain. In me thou seest the twilight of such day. Our image has moved. First quatrain was what? Seasons. And looking at autumn. Our second quatrain still deals with time. But in the second quatrain, where is the image coming from? Day moving into night, okay? Day to night. Which means as we move imagistically from the first quatrain to the second quatrain, what has happened to the unit of time we're dealing with? It is shrunk. It is being compressed. As the sonnet moves forward, imagistically, we're losing time. Which is again what the poet is talking about, okay? So, here we go. In me thou seest the twilight of such day. If you look at me, you see twilight. Now, twilight is a very specific time of the day. It is that moment when the sun has just sunk below the horizon, okay? Sun is just out of sight, but there is still light in the sky. We can still see. But tell me at that moment, even though he doesn't state it in using the word twilight, we are thinking this, what color predominates? What are the colors we're dealing with? We end up with orange, a hint of yellow, and light reds. And what happens as the sun goes further out of sight? These colors intensify, right? So that our simple yellow of the first quatrain is now changing into more intense colors, sunset colors, okay? And he picks up on that in the next line. As after sunset, so we get the sunset, but by line six, We are after sunset fadeth in the west. And by the time we've moved from line 5 to line 6, we've had twilight, we've had the colors of sunset, we've gone beyond sunset, and the colors have faded in the west. Within 2 lines, boom, time is moving forward. We've gone from twilight to the point where the color is gone from the sky. And the next line makes that clear. Not only is the color gone, but which by and by black night doth take away. And now, boom, there's no color, there's no light, there is simply that black night. But notice the image. It's wonderful. If I read that line to a little child, imagine you're 4 years old, which by and by black night doth take away. Tell me what you see. You see a knight on a horse in black armor carrying something off. And the kid would say, stop that bad man. Okay. There's a wonderful sense of something bad stealing something away, which by and by black night doth take away. And you'll notice as well, we can do this right here. I'm going to go back to the rest of it in a moment, but scan that line, line 7. Which by and by black night doth take away. What happens in the 3rd foot of the line, the middle foot? Black night, what have we got? It's a spondee, and it's emphasized again. I mean, it's just, and we get, and surrounding our things fairly soft, which by and by black night doth take away. It's wonderful. What dominates, what's in the center of the line, is that image of black night stealing something away. It seems somehow wrong, inappropriate, and yet it's the process of nature. It's the sun going down to twilight, the sunset, the colors intensify, they fade, and then black night comes in. And why does it happen? Why has that been carried away? And then we get line 8, the end of the 2nd quatrain. Death's second self, okay, that seals up all in rest. What does death's second self refer to? It's close. It's referring to an actual other word in the poem. Night, precisely. Night is like death's second self. Night and death are linked together. How? Because at night, you become unconscious. You go to sleep, and sleep is like death. Okay? So night covers everything over, brings on darkness, takes away consciousness. So that he's making that link. Night is like death. Night is death's second self. It operates in much the same way. It makes things lifeless. It stops motion. It deprives of light. Okay? So that black night becomes death's second self. And what does it do? It seals everything up in rest. It makes everything go to sleep, but please notice that rest comes on and the last word of line 8 is peaceful, but tell me about the verb seals up. I say to you, seals up, and the connotation almost immediately is
sarcophagus,
coffin, buried alive, and suddenly Edgar Allan Poe enters the poem. That verb is scary. And it's not just that night comes on and puts you to sleep. It's that night is death's second self, and it seals you up in rest. We've got a coffin image. We've got a tomb image. We have a real death image by the choice of the verb. By the choice of the verb, he is giving that impression. Death's second self that seals up all in rest. I'm going to go quickly through scanning the 2nd quatrain. First accented word is what? Me. Everybody see it? In me, thou seest. Second accent, seest. The twi, light of, such day. Everybody got it? except there is one of those accented words that is of no importance whatsoever. Which one? It would be run over quickly. Of is insignificant. We have in the fourth foot a tiny little Pyrrhic foot. Light of. Now, light, notice what happens. Light becomes unaccented. Light vanishes from the line. Normally, light would get an accent. Why doesn't it? Because of the twi before it. Twilight. Twilight. So that the light starts to vanish in power poetically in the line by the use of the word twilight, and it is followed by of. We get a little period, which means, just note this by the side, we have a four-accent line. The first line of the second quatrain only has four accents. As after sunset fadeth in the west. As after sunset fadeth in the west. Okay, there are accents. We've got one accented word that's of no real importance. What is it?
In.
Please notice, it's in the same spot as the of in the line before. It's a Pyrrhic foot. The fourth foot of both lines 5 and 6 are Pyrrhic. We're losing accents. As after sunset, okay, fadeth in the west, which by and by black night doth take away. And suddenly we get an added accent because of that spondee in the middle foot of black night. We get an added beat. We've got 6 accents in that line. It's because of the word black which stands out. And then we get this line. Scan this for me. This is tough. Death second self that seals up all in rest. What is the first accent in terms of the hammered out iambic pattern?
Sec. Right. Sec.
Second accent?
Self. Third. Seals. Fourth. All finally rest.
Good. Good. However, we have one other thing. Listen to the line. Death's second self that seals up all in rest. We need one other accent on what? Death's. Death's. And there's our pattern. I've done this deliberately. Compare line 4 with line 8. We have a repeated rhythmic pattern. Let me just read the two together. Bare ruined choirs where late the sweet bird sang. Death's second self that seals up all in rest. We begin with a spondee followed by an iamb at the end of each quatrain, but there is a difference in the lines. We had 7 accents to end the first quatrain. How many are in line 8, the last line of the second quatrain? 6. We've lost an accent. Remember what happened in lines 5 and 6. We went from 5 to 4. Repeated pattern, it's very similar to the last line of the first quatrain, but now we've lost an accent. I'll go quickly through the third quatrain, okay? In me thou seest the glowing of such fire. The image is now of a dying fire. We are still curiously dealing with time, but what has happened now? Not from the seasons, not day to night, we're down to what? We're down to what? How long does it take a fire to die?
Hours.
A couple of hours. A couple of hours and the fire's out. Time is again restricted. Time is again restricted. We're down to just a matter of a few hours. Question. I haven't brought this up before, but space-wise, how much space do we have in the first quatrain? A whole woods. How much space do we have in the second quatrain? We have day and night. We have the whole horizon until what happens? We get sealed up. What do we have space-wise in the dying fire? A very small restricted space. Let me add one other thing. And he'll make this clear. The glowing of such fire, what colors do we have in a glowing fire? We've got a little bit of orange. We've got a little bit of red. Okay? But compare it with the sunset. What's happened to the intensity? It's very small, it's very subdued, it's down to a few things, and then the next line makes clear the glowing of such fire that on the ashes of his youth doth lie. What color predominates?
Gray.
Exactly. And gray is always associated with what? The coming on of age. Okay. The coming on of age. Little bit of orange, little bit of red, and lots of gray. I got one other thing for you. If we've got a tiny little, we've got a small fire, it's a dying fire, it's nearly gone, we've got a few embers and coals on a bed. What did we use to make that fire? What would the fire have been made by in 1595? Wood. Where would we have gotten the wood? From trees in the woods. When would we have cut it down? In late autumn, early winter. What happened to our wood in the first quatrain? We're losing the very substance of our poem. The place where the poem started is now gone. It's been burned up. That's the fuel. We've chopped down those bare ruined choirs. The trees are gone. We've burned them up. And we're even past the big fire part. We're just down to the embers. We've got a few glowing embers. In me thou seest the glowing of such fire that on the ashes of his youth doth lie, as the deathbed whereon it must expire. This is it. This is the end of it. The embers, the fire, is dying on the very thing that supported it. Because those ashes used to be fuel. And now the embers are lying on the ashes. Okay? I love the word, as the deathbed whereon it must expire. You know your Latin. Give me a literal meaning. It means die. That's what he's saying. The fire is going to die. But literally it means what? To breathe out. To breathe out. Okay? Just as when you were born, you had a first breath. The doctor held you up, slammed you on the behind, not just because he was mean or cruel, but in order to make you cry out. And before you could cry out, you had to go, okay, slap, clear the lungs, okay? In order to do that, you took a first breath. It was your first inspiration. You breathed in. You will have a last breath. The moment will come when you quite literally expire. You're old, you're dying, you're wheezing. And finally comes the last one. That's it, the end. You will breathe, you will expire. You will breathe out for one last time and the air will leave your body. Okay? That's very literal. That's very literal. But it's not just an image. What does the fire lose that finally causes it to die? Oxygen. Oxygen. As consumed with that which it was nourished by. You need two things to make a fire. You need fuel, you need air. And what happens is that as more and more ash comes, it chokes the fire. There's less and less fuel, and finally, the ash is all pervasive and there's no oxygen anymore. And the fire dies. So that's a literal image. Just as you will die with your last breath having given up air, the ash of the dead fire chokes out the oxygen and even those embers finally go away and we lose our little orange and gray embers and we just have gray ash left. But what was it that consumed the fire? The very fuel that nourished it. Just as, what is it that makes us grow old? Our youth. And the faster and the stronger you live when you're young, the sooner you're going to die when you're old. In the same way that the more fuel you pour on the fire, the more wood you toss on the fire, the faster the fire is going to burn and the sooner it's all going to become ash. Consumed with that which it was nourished by. The very thing that gave it life is what's going to kill it. The very fact that I had a youth means I'm going to die. I young. Okay. Scan the third quatrain. In me thou seest the glowing of such fire. It's the same thing. Which word don't we need? Doesn't get an accent. Of. Notice where it's placed. In the fourth foot of the line again. Okay? Look at the next line, that on the ashes of his youth doth lie. How many actual strong accents do we have? Which syllables there must get an accent? Ash?
Youth.
Okay. Youth and lie. How many accents? Three. On isn't strong. Of isn't strong. As the deathbed whereon it must expire. As the deathbed whereon it must expire. As the, we begin with a Pyrrhic foot. Deathbed. It's a kind of, they're strong, but death predominates. Bed isn't as strong as death. Whereon it must expire, and the last really, so must inspire. We have maybe three accents there. Maybe you can gear it up to four. And then listen to this line. I'll pound it out. Consumed with that which it was nourished by. But listen to me say it once. Listen to what speech does to that line. Consumed with that which it was nourished by. What has to get an accent? Sumed and nur. We're down to two strong beats. What is happening to the rhythmic pulse of the poem? It's dying. The poem is dying. It's losing beats the way the tree lost leaves at the beginning of the poem. The poem is dying. End of third quatrain, we think it's the end. But we've got a couplet. We have a turn. This thou perceivest, which makes thy love more strong. Wait a minute, what just happened to our accents? They're all over the place. I'm not going to bother to go through it. It depends on how you read it, but we've got accents galore in that line. And after the loss of pulse in line 12, line 3 comes blazing back with trumpets. This thou perceivest, which makes thy love more strong. Please notice, line 1, you mayest in me behold. Line 5, in me thou seest. Line 9, in me thou seest. Line 13, this thou perceivest. What's the difference between seeing and perceiving? The poet's making the claim in line 13 that not only is the beloved witnessing this, but is perceiving it. The information is going in and being processed and understood. I've told you all this, and now you understand it. You don't just see it, you perceive it. This thou perceivest, and as a result of your complete understanding of this situation, your love is growing. This is a persuasive poem, okay? The poet is building a case here. As a result of my having said this, you love me more. This thou perceivest, which makes thy love more strong, to love that well, which thou must leave ere long. Time is short. I'm not here long. I'm going to go. Love me now. And there's the final argument. With one curiosity, leave can mean you must let go of before long, but leave has another meaning, which is what? Bye. Read that line. Who's leaving who? If the poet is dying, who should be leaving? The poet. What does the line say? To love that well which thou must leave ere long. Give me another possible reading. I'm getting old, and as a result, I'm sure your attention is going to go elsewhere. It's hinted at, we've got different possibilities there, which gives a whole new twist, another possible reading to the poem. It's not just that I'm getting old and I'm afraid of dying, therefore love me now and love me a lot. It's that I'm getting old and you're probably sick today. Who wants to hang around with old people? There's a good chance you'll start spending time elsewhere. Don't do it, please. You know, it's not long. It's long. I'll be gone soon. I won't bore you much longer. I want to run through the whole poem in terms of rhyme. Making the point again. A good poem can be read through its rhymes. The rhymes will encapsulate what's going on in a poem. Behold, cold. Hang Sang, day away, west rest, fire expire, lie by, strong long. And you can get the turn in the thought of the sonnet just by looking at the rhymes. Those last two rhymes suggest something significant has happened. There's been a major change. This is a masterpiece. This is an absolute masterpiece. And when I've gone through it, I always get the same question from my students, which is, did he know he was doing all of that? Could he possibly have been aware he was putting all that in there? And the answer is, probably not, insofar as if he did it consciously, he might have gotten maybe 6 of these written in a year. And we know he was turning out about 50 of these a year, one a week, at the same time he was turning out 3 plays. And the plays are more complicated, which means it cannot have been absolutely conscious, the way we would do it, hard work, putting it together, figuring it out. We're in the presence of genius, which is a great mystery. How did Mozart write the trio? It's called the Skittles Trio because he was bowling at the same time. And he'd roll the ball and then run over and had his writing paper and they'd say, you know, Wolfgang, it's your turn again. Oh, I'm sorry. And he'd run over and he'd roll the ball again. And then he'd run back and write some more. And that, you know, how is this possible? And he won the game and finished the trio. We can't do that, okay? That's because we're not geniuses. How did Michelangelo go to the quarry and stand there for hours? And people would say, what are you looking at? He said, well, I'm trying to find the piece of marble that has the statue in it. What? What are you talking about? And then he'd take it back and get it back to the workshop, and then he said he just had to release the statue. Once he found the chunk of marble, then the work was done. Then it was just, you know, he just had to knock the rest of it away. We're not like that. The whole point of genius is it should make us humble in the face of it. These were great gifts that these men were given. They used them well. And you're in the presence of a Shakespeare, you're in the presence of a Mozart, you get to look at a Michelangelo sculpture, and you are reminded of the potential greatness of human beings. But of course, at the same time, one needs to be reminded that it is a gift. And we think of Bach, who at the bottom of every page of music he ever composed, put the little letters SDG. Soli Deo Gloria. To God alone the glory. Because without the source of the gift, there would be no gift. And without the artist being willing to do the work, and as Aristotle pointed out, being true, seeking truth, beauty, and goodness, the art wouldn't be worth looking at. The artist must cooperate with the gift. In the same way that human beings in nature must cooperate with grace in order for God's work to get done. I didn't get to 129, but, you know, Debs de Brakes. Thank you.